Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Back by popular demand is Jeremy Slevin with a roundup of news this week on poverty. Jeremy, how does it feel to be so popular?
I think popular means you asked me to come back, but I'll take it.
Well, I voted, and I really liked our segment last week and decided that it should be a regular thing. So, Slevs, what happened when it comes to poverty news this week?
Well, there was some big news this week in the form of a debate. I don't know if anyone heard about this.
It was pretty quiet. There wasn't much coverage.
Not many people watched it or tuned in. But this was a big deal because right out of the gate...
And this was the presidential debate, the first presidential debate.
In case you were wondering, we're talking about the presidential debate. The first question out of the gate was on income inequality and people who are living paycheck to paycheck. So pretty substantial for the first question in a debate to actually focus on people who are struggling to make ends meet. Lester Holt, the moderator, really did press the candidates on what they would actually do, for example, to bring manufacturing jobs back. But this next debate is going to be a town hall, and they're asking for questions from social media. So what we're doing here at Talk Poverty is launching a campaign called Where Do You Stand? Hashtag Where Do You Stand? Inviting all of our listeners and all of our followers on social media to tweet or to post on Facebook their questions that they want asked at the debate.
I love that you led when it comes to news with like something that you're working on. Not self-serving at all. There's nothing else going on this week that is more important than what you are working on, Jeremy Slevin. Now we know. But in all seriousness, I think this is really important because, you know, there's a lot of folks who feel that poverty, inequality, these issues don't get talked about enough in debates. And I think that's totally true. But it's not about the quantity. It's about the quality.
Exactly.
And so what's so important is to push past nice talking points or just, hey, I really care and I've got a plan. It's like, no, what are your policies? Which I think Holt actually did a fairly good job of doing, as you noted, because if you don't, right, then you take a look at Media Matters, who actually dug into media coverage of poverty and inequality this past year. And guess which network is doing the most poverty coverage?
PBS.
Well, they do good poverty coverage, high quality, but it was Fox News. And that tells you everything you need to know. If the only measure is did they say the P word, then no, because Speaker Paul Ryan would get an A+, and so would a lot of folks who have really damaging policies. So kudos to you guys. Excited to see what comes of this and to really push the moderators to ask not just what do you think, but where do you stand? And I would love to read some of those tweets on air.
Great.
What else is going on this week is apparently less important because you're not working on it, Jeremy?
Something I'm not working on, directly at least. Congress finally came up with a deal to fund the government. The president signed it into law on Wednesday, and it funds the government through the election, so till December 9th. Good news because there won't be a government shutdown. Bad news, there was still not funding for Flint, Michigan, who has obviously been suffering with the water crisis for months now, since February when it first broke out on the national scene.
And that was just when it became public, right? The families there have been suffering for a long time. So still no emergency relief for Flint.
Right. The good news is the House is now including it in a water bill, which we expect to come up in December, but there's no guarantee that there's going to be funding. And still, until December, the people of Flint have to wait.
So good news, no shutdown. Bad news, still no help for Flint. It's really, really discouraging. And my heart continues to go out to the families that really need help. So here's hoping Congress does the right thing at least later this year. Yep. What else we got going on?
So also this week, also in Congress, Senator Sherrod Brown introduced a new Young Child Tax Credit. And this is a huge deal because it would give young children, I believe up to the age of 5 in this case, an extra tax break, essentially, a monthly payment to help parents of new kids.
It's a really big deal. I mean, I think, you know, we've talked a lot on this show about child poverty and its long-lasting consequences. It impacts brain development. It impacts, you know, all the way through adulthood, kids' ability to, attain certain levels of education, to get jobs, to have good, earnings, employment, and so forth, right? Investing in the early early years of life is really important. So Sherrod Brown, thanks for your leadership and kudos.
Yeah. And this is something a lot of other countries already do, it should be noted. I mean, most developed countries do something like this for the earliest years. So this, hopefully the U.S. can catch up.
A lot of them call it a child allowance, yeah. Right? But instead we have a child tax credit that actually misses the families who need it most. So awesome to see this. And I think it's a Senate companion to the legislation introduced earlier this year by Rosa DeLauro in the House. So it looks like we've got some momentum growing in both chambers, and here's hoping it moves forward.
Fingers crossed. Some other good news. I like ending on good news. So
yeah, bring me more good news, Jeremy.
So this one out of California, about 7 million Californians are going to be enrolled in a brand new retirement savings plan under new law in California. This is a big deal because, you know, a lot of people don't have retirement plans through their employer. And this is the first time a state has really gone ahead and created their own retirement plan on top of Social Security.
Well, that's super exciting. I mean, I think we've talked on the show a number of times about the retirement crisis and how few Americans are prepared for it. I mean, it's in many ways a product of the fact that folks have not been able to save because their wages have been flat and declining. Right. I mean, I think the statistic at this point is that nearly half of Americans don't have even $400 in savings. So we're not even talking about just low-income folks. We're talking about folks well up into the income spectrum.
And you know, in the old days, a lot of employers would have these fixed retirement plans where they would contribute. And now you've seen a rise in 401ks, which over time, people just don't have the retirement savings aside from Social Security that they used to.
Well, so exciting to see this. Definitely a trend that we've started to see in the states, and one that it will be important to watch because I think it could be a really potentially successful model.
Fingers crossed again.
So, Jeremy, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio for no longer your American radio debut. That's already happened. Now it's just back by popular demand. But looking forward to having you back next week. And thank you for helping us out with the news in case we missed it.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So Jeremy mentioned the debate that took place earlier this week. Going to be digging into an issue that was front and center in that conversation, stop and frisk, and what it means for the conversation around criminal justice reform and public safety. And then we'll be talking a little bit about childcare and how the evolution of the childcare expansion movement actually traces back to the early years of the welfare rights movement. Stay tuned.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. In 2012, the New York City Police Department began to drastically curtail its use of a policy called stop and frisk. At the time, many claimed, including the New York Post, that the reduction in the use of stop and frisk would lead to more blood in the street. Stop and frisk is back in the news to explain what it is, what it isn't, and whether it's constitutional. I've got with me Jason Williamson. He is an attorney with the ACLU's Criminal Law Reform Project. Jason, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me, Rebecca.
So to help us kind of kick this off right, what is stop and frisk? What does that even refer to? I know the term gets used a lot, but what are we talking about here?
Yes, I'm so glad you asked, and I'm also really glad that you guys are engaging in this discussion and that stop and frisk has become part of the national conversation on criminal justice. I think it's an important thing for us to tackle. So to your question, you know, I want to first dispel this myth that stop and frisk as a general matter is unconstitutional. The truth is that stop and frisk is a law enforcement tactic that is used by police departments all around the country and has been for many years. New York City Police Department did not invent stop and frisk, nor are they by far the only agency to use it. And essentially all it is police officers being able to detain people temporarily in order to facilitate their investigation of a crime or of a tip that they may have received. Now, what is unconstitutional is stopping and frisking people for no good reason. And that is what the court in the Floyd case determined, that the police department was stopping mostly black and brown people in New York City without what is called reasonable suspicion, which is a legal term that's difficult even for lawyers to understand, I think. But it essentially means that the police can't just stop people because they have a hunch or because they don't like how you look, but that they have to have some reason to believe that you may be involved in criminal activity.
And you're referring to a lawsuit called Floyd versus the City of New York, which I want to dig into in a minute. But backing up just a second, just to even get a handle on what stop and frisk even refers to, give me an example. If I'm walking down the street, maybe it's late at night, I've got on my hoodie, right? Because that's going to make me a target for the police. Sorry, I'm in a cynical mood today.
Right.
So what's playing out here that gets referred to as stop and frisk, and how did this policy even come about?
So, for example, you're walking down the street, and so let's look at two scenarios. One legal stop, one illegal stop. So let's say you're walking down the street, the police have received a call that someone has just robbed a store, let's say, and they're wearing a purple hoodie, and you happen to be wearing a purple hoodie. You're in the area, the police arrive on the scene, and
I fit the description because the person who did this has blonde hair and is small and is wearing a purple hoodie, right? So I fit the description.
Correct. So you fit the description. The police, under those circumstances, would be permitted to detain you, to stop you, ask you questions, try to determine based on your answers and whatever other circumstances may be going on, whether or not there's enough there to arrest you. And that's important, which is to say reasonable suspicion is not enough for the police to make an arrest, but it is enough for them to stop the person, do their investigation. They have to allow the person to leave after a reasonable amount of time if there's no further reason to hold them. But the stop itself, even if it doesn't ultimately result in an arrest, would be legal. On the other hand...
Yeah, now give me the illegal one. What's not kosher?
So now you're walking down the street. There's been no report of any crime of any kind in that area. The police see you and just think that you don't belong in that neighborhood. There's no one who looks like you who lives around there. And so they stop you and they start asking you questions. The fact that you don't look like anyone else in the neighborhood does not constitute reasonable suspicion and is not a sufficient reason for the police to detain you and to interrupt, your day. And so what was happening in New York and what happens all around the country is that the police were stopping, as I said, mostly black and brown people in the city without any particular reason, either because they found them in what they considered to be a high crime neighborhood, or because they may have vaguely fit a description that the police had heard, or for any other reason that just, at least where the court was concerned, just did not meet the standard that's required under the Constitution.
And you're referring to the court, and it's the court here in the Floyd case that you mentioned. So what did that case ultimately say, and what was the impact for how New York City's police department uses this policy?
So the court ultimately determined that the NYPD was engaging in two separate constitutional violations. One is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, that they were stopping and frisking people without reasonable suspicion, as I mentioned. And the other was a violation of the 14th Amendment, which, among other things, prohibits the government from discriminating based on race. And so the court found that the NYPD was engaged in racial profiling, and that they were making these stops based on the way that people look.
And
that's just not permissible.
And in the hypothetical of me, the blonde walking down the street with my purple hoodie, that's actually a great example of what's not happening in the abuse of this policy, is what you're saying, right? It's by and large black and brown folks who are the ones being stopped abusively.
That's right. And one interesting thing, in New York, at its height, the use of stop and frisk resulted in you know, over 600,000 people being stopped over the course of a single year. The vast majority of them, or roughly 90% of them, were black or brown, black or Latino. But the interesting thing is that 88%, I believe it, that's the number, of those stops resulted in no further action, which is to say the vast majority of those stops did not uncover any firearms, did not uncover any illegal drugs, did not uncover any other sort of contraband. And so it begs the question, and certainly was something that troubled the court in Floyd, that despite making all of these stops, they were not resulting in any crimes being solved or any criminals being put behind bars. And that, of course, is important because a lot of the rhetoric that you mentioned about, you know, the blood was going to be running in the streets if the police were not allowed to do this, was just was really based on a false assumption, which is that stop and frisk in the way that the NYPD was doing it was actually effective. And there's really no evidence to suggest that it was. In fact, crime in New York City and around the country has been going down for the last 40 years. So going down before stop and frisk was instituted in a more aggressive way in New York, and it's continued to go down since the practice has been curtailed.
And in fact, just putting some numbers to that, the New York Times reported earlier this week that murder is down 32% since 2011, which was the last year in New York City of the old stop and frisk era.
That's correct. So
it's dropped tremendously in the years since the curtailment of stop and frisk.
That's correct. And, you know, one thing I want to make sure I mention is that you know, this case was on appeal up until Mayor de Blasio was elected in New York City and ultimately decided to drop the appeal on behalf of the city. And that, I think, was the result of a lot of work done by folks here in the city, including our New York affiliate, the New York Civil Liberties Union, which did a lot of fantastic work both in court and also in the court of public opinion, making sure that people understood what was going on and what was at stake, so much so that it became a campaign issue here in the city. And Mayor de Blasio made that change when he came into office. So I just think it demonstrates the fact that when people start paying attention to what's happening, it can be a powerful motivating factor for folks to rally around and start to hold government officials, and particularly police departments, accountable for what they're doing.
So murder is often the kind of statistic that people go to in stop and frisk conversations. It's also often what folks who are proponents of stop and frisk point to when they try to say, you know, all sorts of histrionic things about what will happen if we don't have this policy. Right back to the New York Post, more blood in the street, one of its characteristic headlines.
Right.
But more broadly, what do we know about public safety in New York apart from just the murder rate?
Well, I think it is very difficult to tie public safety to stop and frisk generally. There was a study that was out I think a few days ago noting that serious violent crime is going on all around the country except for a couple of select cities, New York City not being one of them. I think the trend continues or has continued over the last several years here in the city and across the country. I want to be clear that for those folks who think that stop and frisk needs to be instituted in a place like Chicago, let's say, where we know violence has been a real issue over the last several years especially, the police are still permitted to stop people that they find suspicious. They are still permitted to intervene if and when they have good reason to do that. And so what it really means is that we need good constitutional policing. We firmly believe that the police can do their jobs within the parameters of the Constitution and still protect public safety, which I think is what's happening here in New York City. if you look at the at what the numbers actually say.
So let me and I want to add one other number too to into the mix. I mentioned the numbers in terms of the drop in the murder rate in those years, but during that same period, stop and frisk stops were down by about 97%, according to the police department. So just to put that in context, but I want to play devil's advocate for a second here, right? So as you pointed out, most of these stops, the vast majority of these stops, are not resulting in arrests or any further action. So why is it such a huge problem that folks are getting stopped?
Well, I mean, I think that's a good question. I think anyone who has ever actually been stopped by the police understands that it is not a pleasant experience whether you're stopped for 3 minutes or 3 hours. And there's a reason that the Fourth Amendment requires the government to have a reason to stop you, and that is that we place great value on our liberty. And again, you know, whether we're talking about a temporary stop or, you know, someone having to go to prison for an extended period of time, either way, we're still talking about infringing upon the liberty of the citizens of this country. And so I don't think it is a small thing to ask people to endure being stopped for no good reason. And again, you know, there may be circumstances where the police have reasonable suspicion to make a stop, but for whatever reason it does not lead to an arrest, that doesn't then make the stop illegal. But when you have the kind of numbers that you had in New York and the percentage of those numbers, not yielding the kind of result that you would think you would yield from a law enforcement perspective, it gives you pause, and it gave the court pause in Floyd. And I think the judge rightly determined that many of those stops had to have been made without any suspicion at all, let alone reasonable suspicion.
And of course, again, as you pointed out, given the racial breakdowns of who's being stopped, and again, according to the New York Times, about 90% of the people who were stopped during the period that we're talking about were young Black or Latino men who had committed no crime whatsoever, according to police data. So we're not talking about just everyone in New York being stopped willy-nilly, but a very specific group of New Yorkers.
That's right. And, you know, and I would add that, you know, many of those folks were not only innocent in that moment, but didn't have a criminal record at all, had not been involved in the criminal justice system. But to be clear, even if we were talking about someone who, you know, had been arrested for something else a year before, or who had done time in prison some years prior, none of that gives the police reason to stop that person in that moment. And so, you know, it is true that it may offend our sensibilities most to think about the police doing this to people who have never violated the law in their lives, but it's just as important for people who have made mistakes in the past. And who happened to be going about their business when they were stopped for no reason. I don't think we can tolerate it under any circumstance.
In the last couple of minutes that I have with you, how does stop and frisk as a debate, as a policy, as an issue fit in with broader conversations about criminal justice reform and policing reform and also police community relations?
Well, you know, I think it's a great question. I mean, we could talk about that for the next 3 hours, probably, because I think there are connections to all of those things. I think anyone who is concerned about mass incarceration has to understand that a lot of these stops can ultimately end up in arrests that are unjustified, which then, you know, continue to fill our jails. The police shootings that we've all witnessed over the last few years, including in the last week, are often the result of stops, sometimes legal, sometimes illegal, and those interactions can escalate pretty quickly, depending on the circumstances, as we've seen. And then, you know, obviously, I think most of us would agree that it would be helpful both to the police and to the community for the relationship between the community and the police to improve, and for collaboration to be a real possibility. But it's very difficult to ask community members to collaborate with the police if they feel like they're under siege and are at risk of being stopped every time they step outside the door. So, you know, if the police are willing and able to do their jobs correctly and to abide by the Constitution, I think, you know, you will see more community members be willing to engage, you know, in conversations and dialogue that will hopefully lead to better outcomes.
Jason Williamson is an attorney with the ACLU, a Criminal Law Reform Project. Let me get your title right, Jason. Thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio. And we'll have to have you back because, as you said, we could talk about these things for 3 hours.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Rebecca.
Stick around. Next up, childcare and its origins in the welfare rights movement.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission. Because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Across the country, millions of working families struggle to find affordable, high-quality childcare. For most of those families, childcare is an economic necessity because 65% of children under six have all available parents in the labor force. Meanwhile, childcare is quickly becoming unaffordable for the families who need it most, with the average annual price of a childcare center exceeding $10,000. In 31 states and D.C., the cost of full-time center-based childcare now exceeds the average annual cost of tuition and fees for a public four-year university. But less often discussed is the connection of childcare to the conversation around welfare and the welfare rights movement in this country. A new report from the Ms. Foundation explores the evolution of that fight and that relationship and offers a roadmap for how we leverage today's growing momentum around childcare to get where we need to be. With me to discuss is Aliyama Matthew. She's the Director of Women's Economic Justice at the Ms. Foundation. And joining me by phone is Mary Ignatius. She is the statewide organizer of Parents' Voices and a former leader of the welfare rights movement in the Kensington Welfare Rights Union. Thank you both for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Aliyama, get us started understanding why the Ms. Foundation decided to take this tack in telling the child care story. Give us a little bit of the background of the tie to welfare rights. Where's the connection?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so, you know, the report starts off with this really incredible quote from Johnny Tillman, who was a welfare rights activist that did a tremendous amount of work to really push the field forward. And, you know, Johnny Tillman was daughter of a sharecropper from Arkansas, and she worked in the laundry business in California. And when she went through a personal injury, she was forced to get on the welfare system. And her experience navigating through this welfare system, you know, uncovered for herself, like, the myriad ways that low-income income, women are bullied, criminalized, and even pushed out of any kind of safety net programs that would ensure their economic security. The remarkable thing about Johnny's work is that she became the ED of the National Welfare Rights Organization, and at its height, it organized 22,000 families nationally into a network that was comprised primarily of women of color, and most of the women that were organizing were Black and Latina women, and they were the National Welfare Rights Organization worked in every city and state across the country, and many people don't know this or forget this, or they've skipped over this part of history, but the welfare rights movement was one of the largest grassroots movements in U.S. history, and it was the largest movement that has consistently foregrounded women of color, and particularly African American women, as drivers of public policy and mobilization and organizing efforts. The massive campaigns that were led by the National Welfare Rights Organization led to a bunch of changes around child care regulations, eligibility rules, and other aspects of our public funding system that we still use right now. It also raised awareness among tens of thousands of women on all of the different fractures of the social welfare system that were, it seemed like, for many of them, when you read about their lives, that this was intentionally created to maintain a level of inequality and really curb a person's ability to gain economic security. And I will say the other most powerful thing that the welfare rights movement did was really demonstrate that poor women had the power to make change. And this goes back to like a central focus of the Ms. Foundation, which is to support movement building in the field. And at the heart of any social movement is really organizing. And organizing means helping people to understand their own power and bringing people across their common values and different experiences into this movement is what we think is so powerful. So 5 years ago, the Ms. Foundation recognized that a lot of shifts had happened to women in the workforce. We're living in a different time than we had since the inception of Ms., where we're seeing the increase of women's labor participation. Almost half of our workforce are women right now. In 1970, there was 30 million women in the workforce, and today we have almost 72 million. So that's doubled in the past 40 years. Today, 40% of households in the U.S., women are the primary income earner. You'd think that would mean like greater financial security for women and families, but so many of these women are concentrated in low-wage jobs. There are even higher numbers of women in traditionally like female occupations like care, the health sector, the service industry. And these industries that I named have a populace of women in them, but are also some of the fastest growing sectors in our economy.
Now, I want to interrupt you there just to back up for a second mm-hmm. and ask what may seem like an obvious question, but I feel like it's worth fleshing out.
Sure.
And that's, why was child care a central campaign taken on by the welfare rights movement?
I mean, child care was at the crux of women being able to have economic security. There's that part of, having to work and provide and being able to get some support if you're not working. The need for child care is also connected to child care providers. And we were seeing that many of the women who entered the workforce were also going into a lot of these care jobs.
So Mary Ignatius, you have worked in the welfare rights movement, as I mentioned at the top, in Kensington and in Philadelphia, and actually at one of the organizations that was hugely formative and really in many ways the epicenter of the national welfare rights movement, the Kensington Welfare Rights Union. Where has the welfare rights movement gone since the 70s, when it really was in many ways having its heyday?
Well, I mean, I think where it's, definitely became more decentralized. I think funding become a drought in welfare rights organizing. But you have, especially in Philly, they're still going strong. Over the last 10 years, pushed for a poor people's economic human rights campaign to kind of pick up where Dr. King left off. And I know they are trying to bring that back and make it reemerge as part of this election and moving forward. Challenges that poverty hasn't gone away. It's only gotten worse. The safety net is more tattered and more ripped up than ever before. And so the need for a movement led by those directly impacted is you know, more strongly than ever.
Anyone who reads the newspaper, anyone who watches televised news, you can't miss that childcare in many ways is sort of having a moment. And as the Ms. Foundation's report actually points out, it's having its first moment since 1972. Mm-hmm. How does today's momentum around childcare compare to what we saw in the 70s? Mm-hmm. And is it as interwoven into the welfare rights conversation as it was then?
It's a really great question. I don't think it's as interwoven as it was back then. And I think it's because the folks who have been sort of leading the childcare charge, you know, I feel have kind of tripped over themselves around, is childcare a work support? Is childcare an educational support for children? Is childcare welfare? Is childcare education? I mean, there's been all of this debate and conversation around what it is that it's gotten farther from what's actually happening on the ground with parents who depend on childcare to walk out the door every day. You know, we have language around early learning, early childhood education. I mean, families still call it daycare. It's very challenging to see the disconnection that's happening, but I do believe this moment right now and what the Ms. Report really lays out is an opportunity for the sort of childcare policy and advocacy group to join with some of the organizing groups who are really listening to parents on the ground today to hear about the challenges they're facing today, to recognize the economy that we're facing today, which is, you know, riddled with unpredictable scheduling and parents working multiple part-time jobs and going to school full-time, and just the way the nature of work is today is completely mm-hmm. different. And so I think there really is an opportunity to have a kind of a resurgence of what that movement looked like in 72 and bring it back to where we are today in 2016.
Mm-hmm. Aliyama, same question to you. How does today's childcare movement and momentum compare to what we saw in the 70s? And, mm-hmm. and what did you find for this report?
Well, I think, you know, to answer that question, we have to back up a little bit and think about, like, what has happened to the welfare rights movement. And, you know, Mary mentioned funding. And I think a very critical part around, like, funding and what happened to the welfare rights movement happened right, you know, during welfare reform in 1996. And, you know, for the philanthropic world, what happened is that we turned our attention from talking about things like public subsidies and the public good and the role of government and TANF and, you know, housing vouchers and childcare subsidies, which used to be part of the conversation that was being funded and fueled in the field, right? And then when welfare reform happened, you know, a lot of philanthropic institutions switched into looking at what is a good job, you know, and the conversation and focus and strategies became focused on, you know, creating good jobs like wages, benefits, you know, hours was our definition of a good job. And I think the other thing that happened to the welfare rights movement, you know, was in some ways the 80s, right? Like we entered into a different kind of conservative era and a different way that we looked at like economic progress in this country and a different way that we even thought about jobs, because jobs were about investing in like infrastructure and buildings. And it wasn't so much around like families and communities and childcare. And in the 80s, we had the creation of the welfare queen, right? Like this media kind of generated image, which sort of tarnished the idea of what is a public good. Childcare has been offered in the history of the United States at different moments. When men went off to war in World War II, we had a federally subsidized childcare program. It was seen as a work support. It was seen as a publicly funded system. So I think there was like a different environment when leaders like Johnny Tillman came on the scene. One of the other things about the welfare rights movement that I mentioned a little bit earlier was that it was a really grassroots-led movement. It was poor mothers and parents and children organizing, marching, understanding like what their rights are, and then pushing to change policies. This attention into good jobs had taken a lot of resources away from those sort of grassroots efforts and funding some of these organizations that were working on this. And so, and I think where we are in this moment is that we have a lot of national organizations organizations and unions and allies that are coming into the childcare world and seeing the importance of it. We have city officials and governors that have started to talk about childcare and early childhood education. So I think there is a moment right now where we need to really galvanize like all of the forces that are talking about labor and work and really see that our lives don't stop at the doors of our jobs, but like, it, you know, what happens outside of work impacts what happens inside of work, and workplace policies are connected to how people can access care. And so I think we're at a really incredible moment right now. And I think what we cannot overlook in this moment is the role of grassroots organizations and building grassroots infrastructure, particularly at the city and state level, because that's where a lot of these fights are happening. And we really have to figure out how do we connect that momentum and the parents and low-income workers who are involved in that fight to a national conversation and campaign and policy change around childcare.
You mentioned a shift to good jobs and, mm-hmm. and that being really a dominant theme in the poverty and economic justice conversations. You also implicitly mentioned race by mm-hmm. mentioning the welfare queen, which mm-hmm. is one of our not so happy legacies of President Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to have a conversation about childcare mm-hmm. without both thinking about jobs and particularly mm-hmm. job quality mm-hmm. and also race. And Mary Ignatius, I'm curious how you see those themes fitting into the conversation we either are having or should be having today.
Well, in terms of job quality, the jobs that are available for low-income women, particularly low-income women of color, are jobs in retail, restaurants, food service, hospitality. Those are the jobs that often are the ones that are changing week to week, are low wages, parents are having to travel farther and farther to get to these jobs. And so when the availability of jobs are reduced to this, you see that the quality isn't there. And the mantra in a lot of welfare offices is get a job, any job. It's not, you know, get a job that's actually going to help build your family's economic security so that you no longer qualify for any of these public assistance programs. When we look at our membership of parents in California, those are our members. They are the restaurant workers. They are the retail workers, they are working at front desks of hotels. Those jobs are shifts that are overnight. They are graveyard, they are 3 p.m. to 11, and they change, their schedules are never set.
Which can make childcare incredibly difficult to secure and maintain.
Incredibly, absolutely. Vouchers for childcare offer the most flexibility. They allow a parent to choose either going to a child care center, a family child care home, or a family friend or neighbor. And it's often in family child care or family friend or neighbor care where you find providers who can offer that flexibility, who are willing to kind of go with the ebbs and flows of your schedule. You typically really can't use that at a traditional 7 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. sort of child care center. Our child care system is so antiquated in that it hasn't caught up to this new economy. And so as we talk about the resources that need to go into this system, and as we talk about quality, we need to make sure that we are lifting up quality wherever children are and across all settings so that the choices that families can make based on their job schedules, based on a variety of their needs, can be quality choices.
Now, Aliyama Matthew, the job quality conversation also extends to the child care workers themselves, mm-hmm. and that's a piece that's often missing from these conversations. How should we be thinking about that, and how does that fit in with a robust but also affordable child care system?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a really great question, and I think that's the question of today. You know, because there's a dependency that child care providers have on subsidies themselves, it's not just poor parents. parents who are getting these subsidies. It's also the providers. You know, it makes like the state. The state is an unusual employer to child care workers, right? And if you're in a center-based setting, and, I mean, it depends because there's a whole variation on how on the different forms of child care. But I think it's important to point out that they're not the subsidy system is a key player in how the profession of child care and how people can get good quality jobs and wages. I do want to point out one thing, that there is like this symbiotic relationship between low wages and government subsidies, is what I also hear you saying. And a really good example of this is with one of our grantee organizations, Restaurant Opportunity Center. They organize restaurant workers in 19 different cities across the country. You know, and that's where this battle for good jobs is really taking place. For people who don't know, the federal tip minimum wage is $2.13 an hour. As our cost of living has gone up, and even as the minimum wage has gone up, like even here in D.C., the minimum wage has gone up, but the tipped wages have just slightly gone up. Living off of like $7.25 is hard, but living off of $2.13 and living off of tips is really difficult. And they actually, we supported them to fund this report called A Third Shift that really looked at how, you know, erratic scheduling, subminimum wages, lack of paid sick days and family leave, all have an effect on the quality and access to childcare. One of the things that emerged out of this work, this issue around, you know, untraditional hours and who provides care then. And we're working very closely with them to explore this issue of night care. And I say that because I think that part of the work right now is we have to push for a universal, publicly supported childcare system, but we also have to fix some of the broken things that are in place. We have to update some of the ways that people can access child care according to the way that workplace culture has changed. So if people are working 2 to 3 jobs and need night care, we have to accommodate for those things.
So Mary Ignatius, going back to you, because I also don't want to lose the second part of where we were headed before, which was race and the relationship between race and the child care conversation. This is part of what the Ms. Foundation's report really tackles head on, and very explicitly by exploring the role of Black women as caregivers, which, as the report points out, dates back to conditions of forced servitude under slavery. Mary Ignatius, I'm curious if you could really unpack a little bit for us how race plays into the child care conversation, and in particular, how it also ties back to its origins in welfare rights conversations.
Yes, I mean, the history of slavery and who minds the children can still be seen today. If you look at our the child care workforce, it's predominantly women of color, Black women, immigrant women. And if you look at those who qualify for child care subsidies, it's the same population, and they're often actually being pit against one another because the resources are so low. As I mentioned before, the jobs that are available are being held by predominantly women of color. And these are, you know, they're not coincidences. These are things that have been part of the fabric of our society from hundreds of years ago. And when you add on to that the wage gap for not only just men and women, if you add into that the wage gap for Black women and Latina women, it's 66 cents, it's 55 cents to the dollar. All of this adds up to extreme inequality for women of color. And that's what our work is about, is really calling attention to it and making sure that those women who are directly impacted are telling those stories and calling out race, calling out class, calling out gender. I would say in our child care policy world, that's definitely been missing. When we look at the qualifications for child care subsidies in California, I can speak to, the income data is based on data from 10 years ago. And so we have mothers who are turning down raises, turning down promotions, cutting their hours, because if they go over one penny over those outdated income guidelines, they lose their child care subsidy. And a lot of these women are already being impacted by the wage gap, already impacted by low wages, and they can't afford it, and they can't move forward. And the mantra that we're being told is, you know, you lift yourselves up by your bootstraps, you follow all the rules, you will get ahead. And that is simply not the case. There are tremendous barriers and walls that a lot of our groups, a lot of the cohort of Ms. Foundation are trying to fight through.
And that is what you're referring to, which is often called the cliff effect. It is something that some states have actually shown. We know what to do here. We know how to solve this problem. And it's about longer verification periods or mm-hmm. making the income eligibility on the back end different than maybe what it is on the front end, so that people are able to climb out in a gradual phase out way. But Aliyama, you wanted to get in here as well.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the cliff effect, one thing I will say is that, you know, one of the things to watch out for, and I think a challenge in the field, is that, you know, even some of the successes that we have, like raises in the minimum wage, you know, drastically affect like people's ability to get childcare subsidies, right? Because you're
or keep it.
And so we have to be conscientious, like going forward, about how we balance like some of our successes and who we compromise, because we've been in a language around the workplace and not looking at some of the, you know, supplementary things that are needed in order to work. So that's one thing. And then,
but it isn't a reason not to raise the minimum wage.
It is not
right?
a
that's
reason.
That's not what you're saying.
That's not what I'm saying. Is that we have to make sure that that everybody gets to have a good quality life, and certainly raising the minimum wage far above what it is right now is central to that. But we also have to figure out, I mean, really what needs to happen is the federal poverty line needs to move, right? Like we were using, like this is about the mm-hmm. old systems that we're using, so that it matches the culture of work and wages that we're experiencing right now.
Which is definitely something we've talked about extensively on this show, and actually as recently as a couple of weeks back because of the release of the new census poverty data. But I think what I hear you saying is that we need to not be having siloed conversations about, say, raising the minimum wage, but we need to think about the other policies that a family confronts, because mm-hmm. one family isn't dealing only with one policy. They're dealing with all of them in connection.
Yes, that's
but
right.
I interrupted you. So
no, the other thing I wanted to say was just going back to this question around gender and race within childcare. You know, one thing to note is that is the historic devaluation of women and women's work, right, that we haven't sort of talked about yet. And that, you know, a large part of that is in the way that care, you know, like women are seen as caregivers, and that has become like habituated into an unpaid profession, right? So out of the gate, the care profession was, you know, sort of sidelined in our economy. It wasn't sort of, you know, put into our GDP. Like we as a nation are not, you know, habituated to see the role that care plays, like even unpaid, like mothers staying home, you know, that's there's a value to that. So I think we're fighting against and you know there are you know, many of the people who took care of children who went off to work have been historically been African American and now Latina and Asian immigrants from other countries, right? And I think the National Domestic Workers, you know, really tell this story really well, that a lot of the protections that domestic workers should have right now were not given to them when the National Labor Relations Act got signed, because they were many of the women who worked as caregivers were former slaves, you know, entering the mainstream workforce. And a way to ensure that they would not get equal pay was to strike them, and protections was to strike them from any representation in the National Labor Relations Act. And so that kind of history that we have, you know, plays itself into the systems that, you know, Mary runs into all the time working with like low income parents in California. And so I just wanted to connect these issues of the devaluation of care and gender with the kind of racialization and distress that has been created in the care sector.
So, Mary Ignatius, turning back to you, and in the last 3 or 4 minutes that we have, I'm curious to hear really from both of you, but starting with you, Mary, about sort of where do we go from here? Mm-hmm. We have all of this momentum. Childcare is in the news. It's being talked about in the presidential campaigns. Mm-hmm. It's being talked about by now members of both parties in Congress. How do we take this momentum, which we haven't seen since 1972, mm-hmm. and channel it into action that is the that will implement the policies that we need to see?
Well, I think healthcare reform a couple of presidential cycles ago really came about with a very deliberate 50-state on-the-ground network of grassroots leaders and organizers going into communities, having conversations about the healthcare crisis that they were facing. And that led to local wins, state wins, and a broad national campaign to get healthcare reform done. I really hope that we can have something very similar in the childcare field. And I believe that we need to make sure that parents and childcare workers are at the forefront and central to those conversations. When it comes to policy, we often look at research, look at data, make assumptions and presumptions about what's best for low-income children, particularly Black and brown children, but we do that without their parents. We do that without the workforce who have to address different standards that are coming down on them. And so my hope is that, you know, the conference that Aliyama has just left, the We Won't Wait campaign, that conversations that are bringing together low-income women of color, whether they need subsidies or are working in the childcare field, organizers who have the skill set to get down into the community to find both of these folks, labor, philanthropy, the national childcare sort of policy experts. We need to have a moment where we all come together, address the different ways that we come into this movement as well, because we do have different perspectives and lenses, and come up with what the strategy is to move forward. I think we can't do it siloed. I really have this dream of the reproductive justice folks, the criminal justice folks, mm-hmm. the education justice folks, all of us coming together to talk about childcare, because it's been that conversation hasn't happened, but I do see this as an issue that crosses, across all sectors, across all families, and this is the moment now. We're seeing, we're even seeing the expulsion rates and suspension rates of 4-year-old Black boys in preschool. Right? Like, we need to start to have the conversation and change the language from school to prison pipeline to preschool to prison pipeline. We need help bringing in a social justice conversation around childcare. And so I'm eager, I'm excited. I've been waiting for this for 11 years. Folks have been waiting for it for a lot longer than me. And the urgency is now. I can't tell you the thousands of stories and parents who I've talked to over the course of my career, and the how hard they work and yet how little comes out of that. And we need big solutions that are, collectively identified.
And Ali, Emma, Matthew, in the last minute that we have, you bring the perspective as not just an entity that produces research like this, but also as a philanthropist and a funder that doesn't just fund national organizations, but that very intentionally also funds low-income parents, low-wage workers, domestic workers, early childhood professionals. Same question to you from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Mary that, you know, at the center of this conversation has to be the people that are most impacted by it. And our role in philanthropy is to really build a groundswell right now and invest in this motion that's going on around childcare and figure out ways to have these conversations over different silos and be able to connect childcare with a lot of different things like the criminal justice system, immigration, a number of different things. I think this is a really important time to think about what the role of government is. And ensure that like all work like that one of the roles of government is that all working people have access to adequate wages and benefits that they need. But I think the other part that we have to be very diligent about is really discerning between different types of welfare systems and really naming corporate welfare, because you know in this you know of recent past there's been a lot of conversation around austerity and you know governments really claim you know, this idea that we don't have enough money, but there is money there and it is going to certain places over other places. And just the fact that, you know, I think the wages, for example, at Walmart and other sort of large scale corporations, the amount of money that they withhold by giving low wages and eliminating benefits actually creates a burden on the federal government system, right? And we have to be very clear about that critique, because if we don't make that critique and see it and really pull it out, we're just having this conversation between the people and the government and not admitting that there's a third entity, which is the corporation, right? And the way that companies do this work.
The report is called Raising Our Nation, Forging a More Robust and Equitable Childcare System in America. And I've been speaking with Aliyama Matthew, the director of the Women's Economic Justice Program at the Ms. Foundation. And joining us by phone has been Mary Ignatius. She's a statewide organizer at Parents Voices in California. Mary and Aliyama, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.